Chapter 4. Blood. Weapons. Face and name. The coleopter's chattering rotors made it impossible to have a conversation at normal levels in the cabin, and Yosef was reduced to growling into Daig's ear in order to get something approximating privacy.
"It's the pattern I'm not certain about," he said.
Daig had a fanfold file open on his lap, one hand holding in the slips of vine paper, the other gripping a thick data slate.
"What pattern?"
"Exactly," Yosef replied. "There isn't one. Every time we've had a crazed lunatic go on a killing spree like this, there's been some kind of logic to it, no matter how twisted. Someone is murdered because they remind the killer of their abusive stepfather, or because the voices in their head told them that all people who wear green are evil."
He pointed a finger at the file.
"But what's the link here? Latigue, Norte, and the others? They're from all different walks of life. Men and women, old and young, tall and short."
Yosef shook his head.
"If there's a commonality between them, I haven't seen it yet."
"Well, don't worry,"
Daig said flatly.
"There will be plenty of people willing to throw in their half-baked theories about it. After Latigue's death, you can bet the watchwire will be buzzing with this."
Yosef cursed under his breath. With everything else that had been on his mind, he hadn't stopped to think that if the Eurotas Consortium had become involved with the case, then of course the Iestan News Services would have got wind of it into the bargain.
"As if they don't have enough doom and gloom to put on the watchwire already," he said. "By all means, let's add to everyone's woes with the fear of a knife in the belly from every dark alleyway."
Daig shrugged.
"Well, actually, it might take people's minds off the bigger issues. Nothing like a killer of men on the loose in your own backyard to keep you focused."
"Well, that all depends on how large your backyard is, don't you think?"
"Good point."
Yosef's cohort paged through the panes of data installed on the slate with solemn slowness. He paused on one slab of dense text, his eyes narrowing.
"Hello. This is interesting."
He handed the device over.
"Look, see. Blood work," noted Yosef.
It was the analysis reports from the site of the Latigue murder. Multiple testing on samples that confirmed, yes, the fluids all over the walls of the gondola had once been contained inside the unfortunate clerk. At least, almost all of them. There was a rogue trace right in the middle of the scan reports, something picked up by chance from one of the Medicaid servitors. A single blood trace that did not match the others. Yosef felt a slight thrill as he absorbed this piece of information, but he stamped down on it immediately. He didn't dare jinx the chance that Daig might have just pointed out something that could be their first important break.
"It doesn't tally with any of the previous deaders either,"
said the other Reeve. He reached for the intercom horn.
"I'll comb the precinct, get them to run this up to the citizen database."
But just as quickly as it had lit, Yosef's brief spark of excitement guttered out and died, as he read a notation appended to the bottom of the information pane.
"Oh, don't waste your time. Tisley got her people to do that already."
Daig's expression remained neutral.
"Should have expected that. She's efficient that way. No joy, then."
Yosef shook his head. The notification for a citizen ident read, "Not found." That meant that the killer was unregistered, which was a rare occurrence on Iesta Veracrux, or else they were from somewhere else entirely. He chewed on that thought for a moment.
"He's an off-worlder."
"What?"
"A cutter. Not an Iestan."
Daig eyed him.
"That's a bit of a leap."
"Is it? It explains why his blood's not in the database. It explains how he's doing this and leaving no traces."
"Off-world technology."
Yosef nodded.
"I admit it's thin, but it's a direction. And with Telemach breathing down our necks, we need to be seen to be proactive. It's that or sit around waiting for a fresh kill."
We could just hold off, suggested the other man. I mean, if Eurytas has his own operatives inbound, why not let them come in and take a pass over it? They're bound to have better resources than we do.
He gave his cohort an acid look.
Remember that engraving on your warrant rod that talks about to serve and protect? We're called investigators for a reason. Just a thought, said Daig.
Yosef sensed something unsaid in his cohort's words and studied him. To anyone else, Segan's dour expression would have seemed no different from any of the other dour expressions he wore day in and day out. But the other Reeve had been partnered with him for a long time, and he could read moods in the man that others missed completely.
"What aren't you telling me, Dig?" he asked. "Something about this case has been gnawing at you since we had it dropped on us."
Yosef leaned closer.
"You didn't do it, did you?"
Daig made a brief spluttering sound that was the closest he ever came to a laugh, but then he sobered almost instantly. After a moment of silence, he looked away.
"We've seen some things, you and I," he said. "This is different, though. It feels different. Don't ask me to be objective about it, because I can't. I think there's more here than just human madness."
Yosef made a face.
"Are you talking about Xenos? There's not an alien alive in this entire sector."
Daig shook his head.
"No."
He sighed.
"I'm not sure what I'm talking about, but after Horus..."
Once more, the Reeve felt the sudden tension that the name brought with it.
"If I'm sure of anything, I'm damn sure that he didn't do it." "There are stories, though," Daig went on. "People talk about worlds that have declared for the War Master, worlds that go silent soon after. Those who make it out before the silence comes down, they've said things. Talked about what happened on those planets."
He tapped a sheaf of crime scene pics.
"Things like this. I know you've heard the same." "It's just stories. Just scared people."
Yosef wondered if he sounded convincing. He took a breath.
"And it has no bearing on what we're doing here." "We'll see," Daig said darkly.
A thought occurred to Yosef, and he reached for the intercom horn.
"Yes, we will."
He pressed the stud that would allow him to talk to the Coleopter's pilot.
"A change of plans," he said briskly. "We're not going back to the precinct house. Take us to the Eurytas compound."
The pilot acknowledged the command, and the flyer pivoted into a banking turn, the pitch of the rotors deepening. Daig gave him a confused look.
"The traitor's men won't be here for another couple of days yet. What are you doing?"
"Everyone wants to keep Eurytas happy, so it seems,"
Yosef told him.
"I think we should use that to our advantage."
They landed on a tree-lined transit pad just within the walls of the consortium's compound. In a definite attempt to stand out from the more typical Iestan architectural styles of the other great manses in the area, the Eurytas house was modelled on the Cygnus school of design, reminiscent of many reunification-era colony palaces from the early decades of the Great Crusade. It was an open, summery building, full of courtyards and cupolas, with fountains and small pocket gardens that were at odds with the cool pre-winter chill of the day. The two Reeves were barely to the foot of the Coleopter's drop ramp when they were met by a narrow woman in the bottle green and silver of the rogue trader's livery. Standing behind her at a discreet distance were two men in the same garb, but both of them were twice her body mass, with faces hidden behind the blank glares of info-visors. Yosef saw no weapons visible on them, but he knew they had to be carrying. One of the many tenets of the consortium's corporate sovereignty throughout the Tibian sector allowed Eurytas to ignore planetside laws, the Void Baron considered to be detrimental to his business, and that included Iestan weapon statutes. The woman spoke before Yosef could open his mouth, firmly determined to set the rules of the impromptu visit immediately.
My name is Bella Gorosp. I'm a consortium liaison executive. We'll need to make this quick, she told him with a fake smile. I'm afraid I have an important meeting to attend very shortly.
The woman had the kind of silken Ultima accent that automatically categorized her as non-native.
Of course, Yosef said smoothly. This won't take long. The Sentine require access to the consortium's database of passenger and crew manifests for incoming starships to Aesta Veracrux.
Gorosp blinked. She was actually startled by the directness of his demand and didn't say no straight away.
Which ship?
All of them, Daig added, following his lead.
The automatic denial that she was trained to give came next.
That's impossible. That data is proprietary material under ownership of the Eurotas Trade Consortium. It cannot be released to any local jurisdictional bodies.
Gorosp said the word local as if it rhymed with irrelevant.
If you have a specific request regarding any data pertaining to Aestan citizens, I may be able to accommodate you. Otherwise, I'm afraid not.
She started to turn away.
Did you know Kirsten Lateague?
Said Yosef. That brought the woman to a halt. She covered her hesitation well.
Yes. We had cause to work together on occasion.
Gorosp's lips thinned.
Is that pertinent?
We are investigating the possibility that whoever murdered him is following a vendetta against employees of Baron Eurotas.
That was an outright lie, but it got Yosef the response he wanted. The woman blinked, and she was clearly wondering if she could be next. The Reeve had no doubt that by now everyone in the compound, no matter if they were supposed to know or not, knew exactly how horribly Lateague had died.
We believe the killer may have arrived on planet aboard a Eurotas-operated vessel, he added.
If the murderer was from another planet, then that was undeniable. The consortium ran every intersystem ship that came to Aesta Veracrux, and as a part of Imperial Transit law, all travellers were required to submit to cursory medical checks in order to prevent the spread of any potential biosphere-specific contagions from world to world. That data would exist in the consortium's records. Gorosp was uncertain how to proceed. Her plan to dismiss the Sentine officers and return to whatever her other tasks were had crumbled. Yosef imagined that she was now thinking of a way to deal with this by invoking some higher authority.
Sanctioned consortium security operatives will be arriving in 50 hours. I suggest you return at that time and make your request to them.
It wasn't a request, Yosef told her. And given the frequency of the murders to date, there could be two, perhaps even three more deaths before then.
He kept his voice level.
I think that even the Baron himself would agree that time is of the essence.
The Baron is coming here,
Gorosp noted, in an absent, distant manner that seemed to be half disbelief.
I'm sure he would want as much done as possible towards dealing with this unfortunate circumstance, said Daig. And quickly.
She glanced back at Yosef.
Please tell me again what it is that you need, Reeve.
He resisted the urge to smile, and instead offered her the data slate.
There's an unidentified blood trace listed here. I require it to be cross-referenced with the consortium's database for any matches.
Gorosp took the slate, and her practiced smile reappeared.
The consortium will, of course, do anything possible to assist the Sentine in the pursuit of their lawful duties. Please wait here.
She walked swiftly away, leaving the two silent men standing watch. After a moment, Daig glanced at his cohort.
When Lemna finds out you brought us here without authorization, the first thing he's going to do is rip you down to foot patrol in the slums.
No,
said Yosef.
The first thing he's going to do is cover his ample backside with Telemax so she won't blame him for any fallout. But he won't be able to pull out anything about jurisdiction if we bring him some actual evidence.
Daig watched Gorosp vanish into the main house.
There is a large chance that she may not have anything we can use, you know.
Yusuf shot him a glare.
Well, in that case, our careers are over.
Daig nodded grimly.
Just so we're both clear on that.
The night air was as warm as blood, and humid with it. It was still and oppressive, almost a palpable thing surrounding and pressing down on fond Tariel. He sighed and used a micropore kerchief to dab at his head before returning to the nested layers of hololith panes floating above his cogitator gauntlet. Across the sparse room, in a pool of shadow at the far window, the sniper sat cross-legged, his long rifle resting across the crook of his arm. Without turning, Kells spoke to him.
Are you really in so much discomfort as you cannot sit still for more than a moment? Or is that the twitching something common to all, Vanus?
Tariel scowled at the Vindicare.
The heat, he said, by way of explanation. I feel soiled by it.
He glanced around. Judging by the detritus scattered all about them, the room had once been the central space of a small domicile, before what appeared to be a combination of fire and structural collapse had ruined it. There were great holes in the roof, allowing in the light, tepid rain from the low clouds overhead, and other rents in the floor that emitted smells Tariel's augmetic scent sensors classified as human effluent, burned rodent meat and contaminated fusel oils. The building was deep in the ghetto shanties of the Indonesic block, where low-caste citizens were piled atop one another like rats in a nest.
I'm guessing you don't leave your clade sanctum very often, said Kell.
There hasn't been the need, Tariel said defensively.
He and his fellow infocytes and cryptocrats had taken part in many operations, all of them conducted through telepresent means directly from the sanctum, or from aboard an officio-sanctioned starship. The thought of actually physically deploying into the field was almost an impossibility.
This is my second sortie.
The first being when Valdor brought you looking for me?
Yes.
Kell gave a sarcastic grunt.
What wild stories you'll have to tell when you go home to your hive, little bee.
Tariel's grimace hardened.
Don't mock me. I'm only here because you need me. You won't find the girl without my assistance.
The sniper still refused to look his way, eyes locked on the sights of his long rifle.
That's true, he offered. I am just wondering why you have to be here with me to do it.
Tariel had been asking himself the same thing ever since Captain General Valdor had given mission command to the Vindicare and ordered them out to the tropics. As far as he could be certain, it seemed that operational confidence for this mission was of such paramount importance that detection of any live in-theatre signals transmitted from the Indonesic block to the Vanus Sanctum could not be risked. He wondered what kind of foe could threaten to defeat the finest information security in the Imperium, and found he had no answer. And the fact that such a threat could even exist troubled him in no small degree.
The quicker we get it done, then, the quicker we can leave this place and each other's company, he said with genuine feeling.
It will take as long as it takes, Kell replied. Wait for the target to come to you.
The infocyte disagreed, but did not voice it. Instead, he returned to the hololiths, leafing through them as if they were pages made of glass hanging suspended in the air. Anyone watching him would have only seen the motions of his hands and nothing else. Tariel had tuned the images to a visual frequency only readable by his enhancile retinal lenses. The penetration of the local sensor web had presented him with a minor impediment, but nothing that he would have considered challenging. The infocyte sent a small swarm of organic metal netfly automata out to chew into any opti-cables they found and pass what rich data flows they located back to him. Each fly was by itself a relatively unsophisticated device, but networked en masse, the information the swarm returned could be cohered into a dense picture of what was happening in the surrounding area. Tariel had already assembled maps of the nearby structures, the flows of foot and vehicular traffic, and he was currently worming his way into the encoding of several hundred monitor beads scattered throughout the zone. The Indonesics called this locale the Red Lanes, and the area was a centre for what one might tactfully describe as hedonistic pursuits. The local confederation of warlords allowed the place a great degree of latitude from their already lax legal codes, and, in return, reaped a sizable percentage of profit from the patronage of pleasure tourists from all across Terra and the Sol system. Quite how a place like this was allowed to exist on the throne world was a mystery to Tariel, as much so as the tribes of bandits he had encountered out in the Atlantic plain. His understanding of Imperial Terra was of a nation world united and glorious. That was what he saw through the glassy lenses of his monitors from the safety of his work pod in the sanctum. But now, outside, he was quickly realizing that there were many dirty, messy, dark corners that did not conform to his view of the Imperium. A soft chime sounded from the gauntlet. "Are you through?" asked Kel.
"Working," he replied.
The netflies had bored into a deep subweb of imaging coils, hidden several layers beneath the more obvious ones, and all at once he was assailed by a storm of images from the shielded rooms in a tall building across the square. Images of men, women, and other humans of indeterminate gender performing acts upon one another that were as fascinating as they were repulsive.
I have access, he muttered. Commencing, image match sweep.
The facial pattern Valdor had provided to Tariel phased through the images, one after another, like looking for like. The infocyte tried to maintain an objective viewpoint, but the feeds he was seeing made him uncomfortable. If anything, he felt more soiled by them than by the dirt and humidity of the night air. And then suddenly, she was there. The tawny skin of the girl's face dark in the lamplight of a red-lit room as the trace program found its target.
"Location confirmed," he said.
Good, said Kel. Now, find me a way to contact her before she gets killed.
And so Iota found herself in the room after opening her eyes. She had wondered if it would still be there when she looked again. And it was. This confirmed her earlier hypothesis that the sensations she was experiencing were not hallucinatory, but actually real. On some level, that was troubling to accept. Perhaps, if she'd understood her state more correctly, Iota would not have allowed some of the liberties that had been taken with her physical form to occur. But then again, they had been necessary to secure her cover in the Red Lanes. She remembered those activities distantly, like a half-recalled dream. The persona implants that had been used to bolster the cover identity were crumbling like sand, and recollection of any particular point of them was difficult. It wasn't important. The false overlay was drifting away, and beneath was revealed her real self, such as it was. Iota was not a blank slate, as those who did not fully understand the works of her clade might think. No. She was a fluid in the bottle of herself, a shape without definition, a form needing direction, a space to fill. She surveyed the crimson room, the walls covered with rich velvet hangings sketched with erotic detail in gold threads, the great oval bed emerging from the deep carpeting. Floating loom globes provided sultry lighting, with a shuttered window the only entrance for any natural illumination. The men who ran the Doxy House seemed caught in some peculiar kind of attract-repel balance with her. Iota's gift made them uncomfortable without them ever knowing exactly why. Perhaps it was the hollow distance in her dark eyes, or the silence that was her habitual mien. However the gift manifested, it was enough to unsettle them. Some liked that, taking pleasure from the thrill of it as they might the tread of a scorpion across their naked flesh. Most avoided her, though, She scared them, without ever giving form to their fear. Iota touched the ornamental torque around the dusky flesh of her throat. If only they knew how little of her they really sensed. Without the dampener device concealed in the necklet, the icy void inside her would have spread wide. She sniffed the perfumed air. Iota felt odd to be out of her suit, but then she always did. The silken shift dress that covered her body was gossamer thin, and she continually forgot that she was wearing it. Of its own accord, her right hand, her killing hand, reached up and buried itself in the tight cornrows of her shiny black hair. The hand toyed absently with the plaits dangling off her scalp, and she wondered how long it would be until the murder came. Her eyes wandered to the wooden box on the bed, and that was when she had her answer. The other woman came into the room, striding like a man, and around the back of her scalp she wore an emitter crown, the delicate filigree of crystalline cyper circuits and implant tech glowing with soft light. She towered over the diminutive Iota, nearly 2 meters tall in elevated boots of shiny blue leather, a full and well-shaped body showing through a bustier affair outfit that could only have been a few strips of hide if taken off and laid end to end. She carried a device that resembled a bulbous tonfa in one hand, one end of it bladed, the other crackling with energy. The woman sneered at Iota. The expression was ugly and ill-fitting on her face, and Iota saw the small twitches of the nerves around her lips and nostrils as the crown worked on her.
"Yarn you," said the woman.
The words were slightly slurred. Iota nodded, remaining downcast and passive.
"They tell me there's something odd about you," she said, reaching for Iota's hand. "Different."
The ugly sneer widened.
"I do enjoy things that are different."
Then she knew for certain. There was a small chance it wasn't going to be him, but the clade had invested too much time and effort into inserting Iota into the right place at the right time for a mistake to happen at this late stage. The voice belonged to the woman, but the words and the personality animating her at this moment belonged to Yun Yai Yun, scion of one of the 9 families of the Indonesic bloc, and warlord general. He was also, as intelligence had proven, a deceiver who was disloyal to the imperial throne, in violation of the Nicaea Edict, and suspected of involvement in a counter-secular cult.
"We will play,"
Yun made the woman say the words. He was on the other end of the emitter crown, somewhere nearby, his body in repose while he forced his consciousness onto the flesh of the proxy. It was a game the warlord general liked a great deal, working a meat puppet in order to slake his desires. Iota was aware that many of her guardians back at her clade's holdfast viewed what Yun did with disgust, but she only felt a vague curiosity about him. The same clinical detachment that coloured almost all her interactions with other humans. Iota wondered if the woman Yun controlled was conscious during the activities, and dispassionately considered the psychological effects that might have. But such thoughts were trivia. She had a murder to focus on.
"Wait," she said. "I have something for you."
Iota nodded at the box.
"A gift."
"Give it to me,"
came the demand. Iota let the shift dress fall from her shoulders, and with Yun's second-hand gaze all over her, she picked up the box and brought it closer. Bloodlock sensors released the latches and she presented it, holding it up with one hand like a server offering a tray of food. The killing hand went to the torque and unfastened it.
"What is this?"
A clumsy echo of Yun's confusion crossed the woman's face.
"A mask!"
The loom light fell over the shape of a metallic skull. One eye was a glittering ruby, but the other was a cluster of lenses made from milky sapphire, spiked with stubby veins and strange antennae.
"Of a sort,"
Iota explained. The torque released with a delicate click, and Iota felt a sudden rush of cold move through her, as if a floodgate inside her had opened. At least for the moment, she no longer needed to hold it all in, to keep the emptiness inside her bottled up. Yun made a strange noise through the woman that was half cry, half yelp, and then the psychoactive matrix of the crown began to fizz and pop, the tonfa falling from the proxy's nerveless fingers. With a disordered tinkling peal, the psionic crystals in the headdress began to shatter, and the woman tottered on her spiked heels, stumbling over herself to fall upon the bed. She made moaning, weeping sounds. Iota cocked her head to listen. The same chorus of wailing was coming from room after room down the corridor of the change brothel, as the nulling effect of her raw self spread out. Before the link could fully die, she sprang onto the bed and brought her face to the anguished woman's, staring into her eyes.
"I want to kiss you," she told Yun.
Through the window, across the companionway from the brothel building, the doors of a nondescript residential slum block had broken open, and a tide of panicked figures was spilling onto the street, all of them half-dressed in clothes that marked them too rich to be locals. Iota nimbly leapt back to the floor and unfurled the stealth suit lying beneath the skull helm, stepping into it with careless ease. The mask went on last, and it soothed her as it did so. The weeping woman coughed out a last stuttered word as Yun's hold on her finally disintegrated.
Culexus!
But Iota did not wait to hear it. Instead, she threw herself through the window in a crash of glass and wood, spinning towards the other building. While they waited for Gorosp, Yosef glanced around the landing pad's surroundings. The fountains, which were usually gushing with coloured water, were silent. And when he looked closer, he noted that the well-tended gardens seemed, if anything, considerably unkempt. There were even dead patches in the otherwise flawless lawns. The consortium appeared to be slacking on matters of minor maintenance. He wondered what that small detail could mean in the greater scheme of things. Daig had made an attempt to engage one of the security men in conversation, resorting to his usual gambit of complaining about the weather, but the guard had been disinterested in talking.
"Nice outfits they have," he opined, wandering back to the parked coleopter. "Do you think they have to buy their own uniforms?"
"Considering a career change, then?"
Daig shrugged.
"Or maybe a sabbatical. A very long one to somewhere quiet."
He glanced up into the sky, then away again. Yosef sensed something in his cohort and found himself asking the question that had been preying on his mind for a time.
"Do you think he will come here?"
"The War Master.
Who else?"
The air around them seemed suddenly still.
"The Arbites say the situation will be dealt with by the Astartes."
Daig's manner made it clear he didn't believe that. Yosef frowned. Now he had asked the question, he found he couldn't stop thinking about it.
"I still find it hard to grasp. The idea of one of the Emperor's sons plotting a rebellion against him."
The concept seemed unreal, like the rain rebelling against the clouds.
"Lemna says there is no mutiny at all. He says it's a disinformation ploy by the Adeptus Terror to keep the planets out in the deeps off balance, keep them loyal to the throne world. After all, a fearful populace is a compliant one."
"Our esteemed Reeve Warden is a fool."
"I won't argue that point," Daig nodded.
"But then, is that any more shocking than the idea that the War Master would turn against his own father?
What possible reason could he have to do that, unless he has some sort of sickness of the mind?"
Yosef felt a chill move through him, as if a shadow had passed over the sun.
"It's not a matter of lunacy," he said,
uncertain as to where the words were coming from.
"And fathers can be fallible, after all."
He caught a flash of irritation on Daig's face.
You're talking about ordinary men. The Emperor is far more than that.
Yosef considered an answer, but then his attention was drawn away by the return of the Gorosp woman. Her carefully prepared expression of superior neutrality had been replaced by a severe aspect, concern and irritation there in equal measure. He had to wonder what she had found to instigate so profound a shift in her manner. She held the data slate in her hand, along with a page of vine paper.
"You have something for us?" he asked.
Gorosp hesitated, then tersely dismissed the two security men. When it was just the three of them, she gave the lawman a firm stare.
"Before we go any further, there are a number of assurances that I must have from you. No information will be forthcoming if you refuse any of the following conditions. Is that understood?"
"I'm listening," said Yosef.
She ticked off the stipulations on her long, elegantly manicured fingers.
"This meeting did not occur. Any attempt to suggest it did, at a later date, will be denied and may be considered an attempt at slander. Under no account are you to refer to the method in which this information was brought to you, in any official records of investigation, now or at a later date in any legal setting. And finally, and most importantly, the name of the Eurotas Trade Consortium will in no way be connected to the suspect of your investigation."
The two men exchanged glances.
"I suppose I have no choice but to agree," said Yosef.
"Both of you," she insisted.
"Why then?" said Daig with a wary nod.
Garros handed back the data slate and unfolded the vine paper. On it, Yosef saw file text and an image of a thuggish man with heavy stubble and deep-set eyes.
"There was a match between the blood trace you provided and a single subject listed in our biomedical records. His name is Erno Sig, and he is known to be at large on Iesta Veracrux."
Yosef reached for the paper, but she held it away.
"He was a passenger on one of your ships?"
When the woman didn't answer straight away, Daig made the connection.
"That's a bondsman's record you have there, isn't it? Sig isn't a passenger. He works for you."
"Ah,"
nodded Yosef, suddenly understanding.
"Well, that clears the mist, doesn't it? The last thing the Void Baron would want is the good name of his clan being connected to a murderous psychotic."
"Erno Sig is not an employee of the Consortium," Gorosp insisted. "He has not been a member of our staff for the last four lunars. His bond and his shares were cancelled in perpetuity with the clan, following an incident."
"Go on."
The woman glanced at the paper.
"Sig was cashiered after a violent episode on one of the Consortium's deep space trading stations."
"He stabbed someone."
Yosef tossed out the guess, and the widening of her eyes told him he was right.
"Killed them?"
Gorosp shook her head.
"There was no fatality, but a weapon was used."
"Where is he now?"
"We have no record of that."
Daig's lip curled.
"So you decided to throw him out, just dump a violent offender on our planet without so much as a warning to the local law enforcement? I think I could find a judiciary who would classify that irresponsible endangerment."
"You misunderstand. Sig was released after a period of detention commensurate with the severity of his misbehavior."
Gorosp looked at the paper again.
"According to notations made by a security staff, he was genuinely remorseful. He voluntarily went into the custody of a charitable rehabilitation group here on Iesta Veracrux. That's why he asked to be released on this planet."
"What group?" said Daig.
"The file notes it was part of an informal organization called the Theoge."
Yosef swore under his breath and snatched the paper from the woman's hand.
"Give me that. We'll take this from here."
"Remember our arrangement,"
she insisted, her cheeks coloring. But the Reeve was already stalking away towards the coleopter. The warlord, Yun Yai Yun, bolted upright from the ornate couch where he lay, his robe falling open, scattering the attendants from his sides. He spluttered and snarled, tearing at the web of golden mechadendrites that were wrapped about his head, winding into his ear canals, nostrils and mouth.
"Get these things off me!"
he bellowed, flailing around, knocking over a hookah and table piled with wine goblets and ampoules. With an agonized wrench, he finally freed himself and glared around, looking for his guardian. Yun could hear the sounds of violence and panic in the halls beyond the room. Something had gone very wrong, and a tide of terror was welling up inside him. He turned it into fury as he found the guardian on his hands and knees staring into a pool of vomit. Yun gave him a violent kick.
"What are you doing down there? Get up! Get up and protect me, you worthless wretch!"
The guardian stood, as shaky as a drunkard.
"There is darkness," he muttered. "Black curtains falling."
The man choked and coughed up bile. Yun kicked him again.
"You were supposed to protect me! Why did you fail me?"
His face was crimson with anger. In defiance of Imperial law, without grant or sanction from the Adeptus Terror, the warlord had secured himself a guardian who not only had combatant skills, but was also possessed of a measure of psychic ability. For months, his pet killer had been his most closely guarded confidence, but now it seemed that his secret was out.
"There's a Kulaxus here! Do you know what that means?"
The guardian nodded.
"I know."
When he had first heard the name of the assassin Clade spoken, when the story of what the word meant had been told to him, the warlord did not believe it. He understood psychers, the humans gifted, some said cursed by the touch of the warp. A psyker's essence burned bright in the realm of the immaterium, forever connecting the world of flesh with the world of the ethereal. But if psychers reflected the far extreme of a spectrum, and ordinary men and women, the brief candles of life in the middle ground, then what could represent the opposite end of that balance? The darkness. They were called pariahs. Chance births, less than one in a billion, children born, so it was said, without a soul. Where a psyker burned sun bright, they were a black hole. They were antithesis made manifest, ice to the fire, darkness to the light. And as with so many things, the Imperium of Man had found a use for such aberrations. The Clade Kulaxus harvested pariahs wherever they were found, and rumor suggested that they might even grow them wholesale from synthesis tanks in some secret fleshworks in the wilds of Terra. Yun Yai Yun had never believed in them until this moment, dismissed the very idea as a fiction created to instill fear in the kings and regents who ruled under the aegis of the Emperor. He knew fear now, though, and truth with it. Yun stumbled towards the doorway, and hands pulled at his robes.
"Warlord, please,"
said the attendant. The spindly man was speaking rapidly.
"Stop! The game has not been completed. There is the letting of fluids to be gathered. The sacrament."
The warlord turned and glared at the attendant. Like all the others who ran this sordid diversion for the masters of the Red Lanes, he was draped in strips of silk and painted with bright inks. He had numerous daubs across his skin, repeating the shape of a disc, a rod, and opposed crescents. The design was meaningless to Yun. He tried to shove the man away, but he would not let go.
"You must not leave,"
snarled the attendant.
"Not yet."
He gripped the warlord's arm and held on tightly. Yun spat and produced a push dagger from a pocket.
"Get off me,"
he roared, and stabbed the man in the throat with three quick moves. Leaving him to die, the warlord forced his way out into the corridor. The guardian stayed with him, his face pale and sweaty. He was mumbling to himself with every step.
"Vox!"
shouted Yun.
"Give me your vox!"
The guardian obeyed. A line of blood was seeping from his right eye, like red tears. Barging his way through the change brothel's other clients, slashing a path with the push dagger, the warlord barked a command string into the mouthpiece of the communicator.
"Air guard!"
he shouted.
"Deploy mobiles for zone strike! Now! Now! Now!"
"Location?" asked the worried voice of the coordinator, back at the Yai clan compound.
The Red Lanes,
he replied.
Wipe it off the map.
Lord, are you not in that area?
Do it now.
It was the only way to be certain of killing the Culexus. He had no other option open to him. In the ruined apartment, Kel held his breath and listened. Over the disarray in the street below them, his spy mask's audial sensors had detected the sound of gravity-resist motors.
Vanus, he said. Do you hear that?
Gunships, said Tariel, studying his hololiths. Cyclone class. I read an attack formation.
Kel's face twisted in a grimace, and he ejected the magazine from his weapon, quickly reloading it with a different kind of ammunition. Crossing the courtyard, the warlord looked up into the rainy night as the first salvo of rockets slammed into the buildings surrounding the square. A massive fist of orange fire and black smoke engulfed the tallest of the shanty towers, and curls of flame spun away, lighting new infernos wherever they landed. His guardian was behind him, blinded by a roaring headache, barely able to stagger in a straight line, and with a monumental effort, the Psyker bodyguard hauled himself to the ground car parked near the gates. Dead bodies lay in a circle around the vehicle, shocked to death by the vehicle's autonomic security system. Recognizing him, the car's driver servitor opened the gullwing doors to allow the guardian and the warlord inside. Another strike hit home nearby, blasting tiles off the brothel's roof, sending them down to shatter harmlessly against the vehicle's armored skin.
Get me out of here, demanded Yoon. Stop for nothing.
The guardian, half in and half out of the door, coughed suddenly and blood spluttered from his mouth. He turned, the pain in his skull burning like cold fire, as a figure in glistening black fell the distance from the roof to the courtyard floor. A ring of invisible force radiated out from it, causing a halo of rain to vaporize into mist.
Kill her!
Shouted the warlord, his voice high and filled with terror.
Kill her!
The Psyker took a foot in the spine, and Yun shoved him out of the safety of the car onto his knees. The gullwing door slammed shut and sealed tight. The Culexus assassin stepped forwards as the Guardian got up again, catching sight of the rain rolling down the contours of her skull helm, dripping from the orbit of the single ruby eye as if she were weeping. The Guardian reached inside himself and went deep, past the blazing pain, past the horrific wave of nothingness that threatened to drown him. He found a breath of fire and released it. The pyrokinetic pulse chugged into existence, streaming from his twitching fingertips. The blast hit the Culexus dead on, and she backed away, shaking her distended steel head. But the tiny flare of hope the Guardian experienced died a second later as the fire ebbed, almost as if it had been pulled into the ribbing of the assassin's sinister garb. He was aware of the car moving forwards in fits and starts, but his attention could not stray from the grinning, angular skull. The sapphire eye-clutch shimmered, and the punishing gaze of the weapon known as the Animus Speculum was turned upon him. Power, raw and inchoate, sucked in from the fabric of the warp and from the Guardian's abortive attack, drawn in like light from the event horizon of a singularity, was now unleashed. A pulse of energy flashed from the psychic cannon and blasted the warlord's bodyguard backward, slamming him into the wall of the courtyard. As he tumbled to the ground, he combusted from within, the fire consuming his flesh and his screams. Yun Yai Yun was shouting incoherently at his driver servitor as he'd used the bull bars on the ground car's prow to shoulder pedestrians out of the way. The vehicle made it onto the street as fresh salvos of rocket fire tore the red lanes into rubble. The servitor gunned the engine and aimed the car towards the bridge that led back towards the Yai compound. A black blur fluttered in the light of an explosion, and the armored windscreen cracked and crazed as indigo fire lashed across it. Great gobs of polymer glass denatured and collapsed, smothering the servitor in a suffocating blanket of superheated plastic. The car spun out and collided with a bollard. Yun pulled wildly at the door's locking handle, then stabbed it with the push dagger. He was operating on blind panic. Taking her time, the Culexus clambered in through the destroyed window and disarmed him, almost as an afterthought. The warlord soiled himself as the skull came closer.
Oh, I'm sorry. I'm sorry, I'm sorry, I'm sorry.
Kiss me,
she said, her voice devoid of all emotion. Yun's lips were pressed to the cold steel of the mask, and agony spiked through him. He fell back and spat dust. Raw pain boiled at his extremities as his flesh blackened and became thick ash, crumbling before his eyes, until those too rotted in their sockets and shriveled to nothing. Yun Yai Yun's very energy of life was drawn from him, leached into the force matrix webbing the assassin's stealth suit, until there was nothing left of him but a slurry of indeterminate matter. Iota left the target's vehicle, and the area around her was suddenly drenched in brilliant white light. The downdraft from a gravity drive beat at the ground, stirring up debris and what remained of the warlord. The sensor suite inside her helm registered a gunship's weapons gridlocking onto her silhouette, and she paused, wondering if it were possible for her to die. In the next moment, she saw a line of light across the infrared spectrum as a single high-impact bullet passed through the armored canopy of the gunship, beheading both the pilot and the gunner. Suddenly unguided, the Cyclone's autoflight system kicked in and brought it down to a soft landing. Presently, two men, one in the operations gear of the Vindicare clade and another in a more basic stealth rig, emerged from one of the smouldering buildings. Iota glanced at them, then went back to watching the spreading fires. As the sniper tipped the corpses from the flyer's cockpit, the other man warily approached her.
Iota,
he asked.
Protophage? Clade Culexus?
Of course it's her, said the Vindicare. Don't be obtuse, Tariel.
You have to come with us,
said the one called Tariel. He indicated the gunship as the sniper took the controls. Iota ran a finger over the grinning teeth of her skull mask.
Will you kiss me too?
The man went pale.
Perhaps later,